The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Diane Edelman for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Reader's Digest. Our first article is Buried in a Snow Tomb. The snowboarder was off the trail, head first under 6 feet of powder. To survive, he'd need to change his luck. By Tom Hallman, Jr. Ian Steger was disoriented and scared. Of course he was. He was sprawled upside down in the dark under more than 6 feet of snow, the weight of which was pressing down on his chest, making it a struggle to breathe what little air there was. Steger was an athletic 40-year-old, but that didn't matter. He knew there was no way to escape. A good friend had died just 3 months earlier in this exact situation. Steger accepted that he, too, was about to die. His mind raced, full of images and regrets, of words and feelings he wished he had shared with friends and loved ones when he'd had the chance. Too late now. He had no idea what suffocating to death felt like. He hoped it would be peaceful. Steger grew up in Bellingham, Washington, about an hour or so from where he was now trapped in the Mountain Baker ski area. When he was 2 years old and just learning to walk, his father had hauled him to the area and taught him to ski. He loved it, and he later took up snowboarding on the mountain. His job as a real estate agent gave him a flexible schedule, the chance to hit the slopes whenever he wanted. He typically went to the ski area more than 30 times a year, and he made it a point to be there whenever storms dumped fresh powder. March 3rd, 2023, a Friday, was such a day. The area is nicknamed Powder Mountain. Experienced skiers and snowboarders are drawn to the virgin powder outside the routes maintained by the ski patrol. The backcountry boundaries are marked by ropes and signs to warn people that they're leaving the safe zone. Safe is the operative word. Experts say skiing isn't dangerous, until it is. In 2022, more than 66,000 injuries were attributed to skiing and snowboarding, according to the National Safety Council, which reports that excess speed, loss of control, and collisions with stationary objects, like a tree or a lift tower, are the most common factors associated with fatalities. Knowing that, those venturing beyond the ropes are expected to do so with a partner and to have avalanche gear, a two-way radio, and a backpack with a shovel and snow probes. Steger and his three buddies had all the required gear when they slipped under the ropes for their second run of the morning. They found great powder and the thrill of navigating through the trees. Blazing down the hill, they were aware of tree wells. These hidden dangers occur when low-lying branches hinder snow accumulation around trees, resulting in as much as 10 feet of loosely packed snow that can entrap a person, much like quicksand. And, like quicksand, tree wells often appear innocuous. Digging yourself out of a tree well doesn't have to be onerous. "We've all been there," says Steger. "I've had to dig out a couple of times. You reach down through the snow, find the board, unstrap it from your feet, and pull yourself out of the hole." That's how it usually works, anyway. On that Friday run, Steger's friends were in front of him when Steger, moving through the trees, ran into trouble. The front of his board clipped a small branch hidden under a massive layer of new snow. Upended, Steger teetered before falling backward into a tree well. The winter sports informational site, deepsnowsafety.org, has this advice for skiers who find themselves slipping into a tree well. Yell, or use a whistle to get your partner's attention. Do whatever you can to keep your head above the surface of the snow, including rolling your body and grabbing tree branches or the trunk. And if possible, keep your feet below your head. Great recommendations, but not applicable in this case. Before Steger could call for help, grab a tree root, or make sure his head was above his feet, he was upside down in deeper snow than he'd ever been in. All he could see was pitch blackness. During avalanche survival training, instructors tell students that the first thing you must do when trapped under snow is create an air pocket around your mouth. Steger remembered that from the basic training he had done years before. One of Steger's arms, however, was pinned next to his body. Luckily, his other arm had extended up to his face, so he managed to push the snow away from his mouth, creating a small air pocket. To protect the pocket and prevent snow from falling in and covering his mouth, he grabbed the tip of his jacket and pulled the fabric over his face. And now all he could do was wait. That's what he had been taught. Stay calm and wait to be rescued. Here, however, classroom theory and lectures had little to do with the nightmarish reality facing Steger. All I could hear was the pounding of my heart, he says. To stave off waves of panic, he focused on breathing slowly and consuming less of the precious oxygen while waiting for his friends to come get him. He figured two or so minutes had passed. Then the two-way radio on Steger's shoulder crackled with messages from his friends. Where are you? We didn't see you come out of the trees. Let us know if you're in front of us. He now knew that his friends were downhill from where he was stuck, and because they surely assumed he'd passed them, he correctly assumed they weren't likely to take off their snowboards and make the long, difficult trudge back up the hill to look for him. It would be up to Steger to get himself out. If I didn't, he says, I knew I was going to die. He remembered from his training that a person has about 15 minutes of air while buried in the snow before they suffocate and die. By now, Steger guessed he'd been trapped in this snowy grave for more than 5 minutes. Once more, he summoned all his strength to try to wriggle free. Instead, he sank deeper into the snow. The pressure tightened around his chest, and he sensed the air pocket was collapsing. Then came the dark thoughts. I'll never see my fiancée again, he thought. They'd only been engaged for 4 months. She was the love of his life. But in some ways, he and Jordan Richardson were opposites. Her idea of being in the outdoors was walking the dogs. He thought of Bill Camphausen, his snowboarding friend who had died in late 2022, right here at Mount Baker, where he suffocated after falling into a tree well. Someone eventually spotted the tip of Camphausen's snowboard sticking out of the snow. They dug him out, but by then it was too late to save him. After that, Richardson had hounded Steger to get their wills in order. They'd collected all the documents, and he remembered seeing the papers that very morning neatly stacked on the kitchen table. All they needed was his signature. Steger thought of the aftermath of his friend's death, the memorial, the mourning. Soon, it would all be repeated, but for him. Then came acceptance. There was no sense in freaking out, he says. I was not going to make it. I started breathing slow. I wanted it to be peaceful. I wondered how long it would take for me to die. Then he felt his snowboard, still attached to his feet, move. He felt it again. Was he imagining it? Francis Zuber, a 28-year-old carpenter who lives in Bellingham, had gone to the Mount Baker ski area that Friday to chase powder. Since moving to the city in August from New York, he'd been a regular on the slopes. "I saw a buddy on the chairlift," he says. "He gave me a shout. We met at the top and decided to pop out of bounds. That zone was unfamiliar to me. I picked a random line and took off down the hill." As he sped down the slope, Zuber caught a glimpse of color in his peripheral vision. "Something red," he says. "I didn't know what it was, but it was out of place and made me stop and turn around. That's when I saw the upside-down snowboard in a tree well. It was just lying there as if someone had lost it. Then it moved. Someone was attached to that board." Adrenaline surged through Zuber's body. Determined to help, he unsnapped his skis, stepped out of them, and immediately sank into the snow all the way up to his chest. He was stuck. But he wasn't powerless. He had run track in high school, so now he forced himself forward in a race where seconds counted. Taking low, slow, powerful steps and using his arms in a breaststroke motion to push the heavy snow out of the way, he inched his way up the hill. Full exertion, no letting up, fearing that whoever was attached to that snowboard would die if he couldn't reach him in time. He took another slow step, his knee punching a hole in the snow. Then another step, again led by his knee, while his arms swept snow away from his chest. This went on for a number of agonizingly slow strides until Zuber reached the well, where he used his hands to frantically and violently dig downward. The snow had the thick density that, in another place and time, would make a perfect snowman. In the blackness, Steger, his oxygen running out, felt a hand on the outside of his jacket. "I was tasting stale air," he says, "like when you put a blanket over your head and hold it tight and breathe in and out." Then, suddenly, the darkness began to lighten. His jacket moved away from his face. A hand pushed the snow away from his mouth. Cool, fresh air hit his face, and he sucked as much of it into his starving lungs as he could. Standing over him, Zuber caught the sound of a gasp. "Can you hear me?" he asked. "Yes," replied Steger. "Are you all right?" "Yes. I'll get you out in a minute. Thank you." Zuber unclipped an avalanche shovel and began digging with it, eventually seeing Steger's legs, upper body, arms, and then his face. Finally, he could grab enough of Steger to pull him free and help him stand beside what had almost become a cold grave. Steger coughed up blood. The small air sacs in his lungs had been working so hard they had burst. Both men looked at the blood on the snow. And then Zuber, the rescuer, as thrilled by what had transpired as Steger, the rescuee, wrapped him in a bear hug. "You saved a life today," Steger managed to say. Steger radioed his friends to give them the good news. Relieved, they cheered and told Steger they were more than 100 yards downhill and would meet him there. He and Zuber hugged once more, and then they went their separate ways, with Steger snowboarding down to his friends. Those 10 or so minutes on the mountain changed both men. "It's tough for me to sort the whole thing out," Zuber admits. "Coincidence? Divine intervention? Whatever you want to call it. It's wild. As far as the existential stuff goes, I'm still trying to parse it all out." Ian Steger and Francis Zuber have kept in touch. They even routinely return to Mount Baker to hit the slopes together. "A friendship blossomed from all this," Zuber says. "We've had some great times together." Steger, for his part, believes he's been given a second chance. "The experience allowed me to realize what's actually important in life," he says. "I have a new appreciation to make the most of every single day, because you have no idea if it's going to be your last day." He even signed the will. Our second article is The Craziest Hotel Stay Ever. It all started when no one was at the front desk to greet them. So the friends stepped up, and soon they were in charge. By Bill Hangley, Jr. If the three friends had driven straight to the hotel after the bars closed, they would have found a desk clerk on duty. They would have gotten their key, found their nice anonymous room, and crashed in their nice anonymous budget-priced beds. But the friends were out for adventure. It was Aaron Howard's 28th birthday, and he, Kenzie Brooks, and Noreen Dobani, all from the Atlanta area, were in Nashville to celebrate. The centerpiece would be a Wednesday night concert by one of Howard's favorite bands, the Arctic Monkeys. But the first stop when they arrived in town on Tuesday was to hit Nashville's famous bars, where they partied until closing time. On their way to the hotel, with Dobani behind the wheel as the designated driver, they saw a sign for a casino in Kentucky. Oh, heck yeah! They couldn't resist one last stop. They got on the highway and headed north. The pals had fun, even if they lost a few $100. And now they were all ready for bed. Next stop, the La Quinta Inn and Suites near the airport, an utterly unremarkable yellow-painted box by the interstate, catering to tourists and long-stay guests. It was 5 a.m. when they arrived. They didn't expect valet parking or a uniformed doorman, but they were, well, expecting somebody. "No one," says Dobani. "We were in there waiting, and there's absolutely no one." There was no one behind the big front desk. There was no one in the lobby. There was no one in the office. The friends started to prowl around and soon found somebody, a housekeeper, who seemed as befuddled as they were. With no place to sleep and no way to get a key to their reserved room, they could have gotten back in the car and started looking for another hotel. But then they heard a woman's screams from the elevator coming their way. La Quinta's tagline is, "Wake up on the bright side." She woke up on the raging side. She comes down screaming, "My money's been stolen. My money's been stolen," Brooks says. You could hear her before she even got to the lobby. At first, the friends were baffled by the angry woman. She was hollering about unauthorized hotel charges on her card. When she found the lobby empty of all but the three friends, she immediately called La Quinta's corporate office. That's when things started to get ridiculous. When the woman finally got a human on the line, the friends could hear the exchange. They say, "Okay, ma'am, we're going to transfer you to someone who can help you," Dobani recalls. Next thing I know, the phone on the desk starts ringing. That's right, the phone on the unmanned desk, the reason the woman had to call corporate in the first place. So Dobani did what seemed to him to be the logical thing. He answered the phone. When the unhappy woman realized she'd been handed off to another guest standing inches away, she got even more mad, said Dobani. Soon, another phone line rang. Dobani answered that, too. On the other end, another angry guest. Same problem. Then, other angry, concerned, confused, bewildered guests began showing up in the lobby, saying that they, too, had been alerted about withdrawals from their credit cards. It wasn't just small amounts. We're talking $100, $200, says Brooks. At one point, there were at least 10 people coming down to the desk to complain. We're calling the La Quinta corporate office and saying, "You've got a situation here. It could get really bad." Let's take a second here. Put yourself in our trio's shoes. You're tired. You're wired. You did everything right. You planned ahead, made your reservation, partied all night with your friends, and now you're ready to crash. But instead of a room key and a ticket to Slumberland, you've got nothing. You're standing in a lobby full of angry, venting guests who assume you work at the hotel. You're way out near the airport. Outside, there is nothing but a parking lot and a Taco Bell. You've got no idea where to escape to find another room. So what do you do? While some might have justifiably skedaddled into the night, leaving the other guests to tangle with La Quinta on their own, these three friends decided to stay put. After all, they had experience with angry customers. Dubani, Brooks, and Howard all had spent years in the service industry, selling shoes, pouring drinks, managing staff. They'd worked together at a trampoline park and an adult mini golf course, wrangling kids and their parents at birthday parties, as well as drunks at many a happy hour. Walking away from an obvious problem was not in their DNA. As the woman hollered and others wondered where their money went or how to return their rental car or where their breakfast was, something clicked. It was time to help. "That's what we're used to," Dubani says. "You see something that needs to get done, you step up and get it done." Thanks to his customer service background, Howard was familiar with the kinds of problems that can happen with online booking systems. The solution was for the guest was not to call La Quinta. It was to call their banks and stop the payments. So Howard urged the guests to contact their banks. Dubani and Brooks, still answering the phones behind the desk, followed his lead. He'd managed them before. They let him manage them again. It was a familiar situation. When people are pissed off, they just want to be told that it's going to be okay and that you're going to help take care of it, said Brooks. They just want to be heard. But not everybody could be calmed down. That first angry woman who came down the elevator screaming had grown mad enough to call the police. "I thought it could turn ugly when the cop walked in," says Brooks. "The lady's screaming, and I'm behind the desk in fishnet stockings, shorts, and a t-shirt," she adds. But instead of arresting the friends for impersonating hotel staff, the officer gave the chaotic scene the once-over and decided that he didn't want to get involved. Instead, reports the trio, he told them, "I'm just going to leave. You do what you got to do," and then left. By now, it was clear that the three friends were the closest thing to staff that this hotel had, and the guests needed help. And it wasn't just angry customers anymore. As the sun rose, the hotel's early risers were starting to appear. They wanted to check out. They wanted shuttles to the airport. They wanted transport into the city. Brooks rummaged through the empty office looking for a list of contacts for shuttle buses and taxis. "Every office has a cheat sheet somewhere," she says. She eventually found it and handed the list to Dubani, who was manning the front desk with a smile plastered on his face. As the exchange took place at around 6:30 a.m., a bunch of guys in construction gear stumbled downstairs and took their seats in the buffet area, patiently waiting for their coffee, bagels, waffles, and eggs to appear. Not ones to disappoint, Brooks and Howard got to work. During her time casting around the office for the cheat sheet, Brooks had also found the keys to the cabinets where the food was stored. Here, their experience came in handy yet again, because Brooks and Howard had served food at the mini golf course where they'd worked together. They'd both been certified in commercial food safety. They knew they couldn't safely cook up scrambled eggs or bacon to satisfy government regulations of food safety. One order of salmonella coming up. But anyone can lay out cereal, biscuits, and individual yogurt cups. Back at the desk, Dubani was calling shuttles and helping customers check out as fast as he could. "I'm telling people, yes, go ahead and leave your keys here on the desk," he says. Customers rolled with it. They happily dug in to the breakfast buffet, apparently unbothered by the fact that they were getting served by a guy in a bright red Atlantic Braves jersey and a young woman in fishnet stockings. The friends acted like staff, and the guests treated them that way. The three were still serving breakfast when the morning shift desk clerk finally showed up at 8 a.m. The clerk looked at them quizzically and asked, "Well, what can I do for you guys?" Brooks smiled and said, "Do you know what we just did for you?" By this point, the friends had been up for 24 hours, and what had started as a lark had turned into a job as tiring as any other. When they saw an actual employee, they thought the adventure was finally over. By this point, the friends had been up for 20... Excuse me. "We were flat out exhausted," says Brooks. But the La Quinta Hotel had one surprise left. The newly arrived clerk gave them a key card, and they joyfully headed for their long-awaited beds. But when they opened the door, they found a stark naked woman stepping out of the shower. She let it be known to them that she was unhappy to see them. Brooks, Howard, and Dobani never did find out what had gone wrong with the booking system, but they did get a vague explanation about the empty desk. An employee had left prematurely, without notifying management, and was now no longer with the hotel, according to a statement by hotel officials. The Wyndham Company did eventually show its gratitude, giving the three free rewards points and rewards boxes that included fluffy bathrobes, and Brooks got a free meal out of it. When they met with the Wyndham boss, I told him, "I have to confess, I took some ravioli," she says. He said, "You could have taken it all, and it'd be okay." That was The Craziest Hotel Stay Ever by Bill Hangley, Jr. We've run out of time for today's episode. I'm Diane Edelman, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Reader's Digest is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.